Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, the distinguished federal budget pundit Stan Colander explores the insanity of U.S. fiscal politics today, and Tim Shorrock uncovers the reason behind North Korea's putatively unreasonable missile tests. I was hoping to have someone on to talk about the role of unchecked, unplanned development in contributing to the heartbreaking disaster in Houston, but the authors of an excellent investigation of the topic jointly produced by the Texas Tribune and ProPublica proved too busy to do an interview, understandably. Maybe next week. Suffice it to say for now that building recklessly in an already flood-prone area is a very bad idea. But add to that the intensified storms that are a feature of climate change, and the devastation of Harvey looks like an act of nature with substantial human assistance. On to the more mundane topic of the federal budget. The German sociologist Rudolf Goldscheid said 100 years ago, a quote made famous by Joseph Schumpeter, "The budget is the skeleton of the state stripped of all misleading ideologies." Right now, the U.S. state, perhaps the most powerful institution in world history, is looking ridiculous by this standard. We have a Congress run by reactionary fools, and we have the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, in the hands of Mick Mulvaney, who was until recently a Freedom Caucus loon in the House. And the Treasury is in the hands of Steve Mnuchin, a Goldman Sachs alum with no political experience. The two top executive branch officials in charge of the budget, both led by a president who is a showboating ignoramus. Most of these players seem quite casual about the risk of a default on U.S. Treasury bonds, which, without exaggeration, are a financial cornerstone of bourgeois rule. This is a stunningly bizarre situation, a symptom of a ruling class in possibly terminal decline. For an overview of D.C. budget politics, I turn to Stan Colander, who's been in that charming city for 4 decades, much of it immersed in federal budget issues. He spent many years in the congressional staff, then moved on to Price Waterhouse. He's now an executive vice president at MSL Group. He tweets as the budget guy. Stan Colander. Before the hurricane hit Houston, the budget scene was pretty messy. So let's just forget about that for a moment and just lay out what's coming up in the next few weeks.
By October 1st, the start of the fiscal year, Congress has to pass a continuing resolution or some funding mechanism. Otherwise, the government will shut down at midnight, December 30th. You've got the debt ceiling. The government's going to hit, they're going to literally run out of cash somewhere around the beginning of October. And then because of Hurricane Harvey, now you've got emergency funding that has to get provided for the areas hard hit by the flooding and by the hurricane. So in normal times, if everybody got along, if this was all under one party control, if everyone could agree on doing things rationally, this would be a tough road to hoe. But when Congress gets back to work, they've got the Senate's only going to be in session 12 days, so there's not enough time to get any of this done, let alone all of it.
Not enough time to get any of this done, meaning the government will shut down?
Well, there's a pretty good chance. I mean, what's complicating this even further is that the craziness going on in Washington, particularly in this case, the president saying, as he has demanded through most of August, that he's not going to sign a continuing resolution and maybe not a debt ceiling unless he gets money for the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. It's entirely possible that Congress could send the president a continuing resolution, a so-called clean continuing resolution, that just keeps funding going at the current levels, doesn't add anything, doesn't take anything away, but doesn't give the president the money for the wall that he wants, and the president vetoes it. Now, what happens if the Congress sends him a clean continuing resolution that has aid money for Hurricane Harvey attached to it? And he vetoes that. Entirely possible. What was already crazy is now in Washington has become even a little bit crazier because the president's so unpredictable and because the hurricane has created such a demand for a federal assistance.
Is anyone taking Trump's threats seriously?
I think everybody is. Every Republican consultant I know, every Republican budget wonk, is doing the same thing that every Democratic consultant and budget wonk is doing, which is basically shrugging their shoulders and say, we don't know. The White House has become so unpredictable, it's not clear who's actually running, the legislative liaison. It's not clear what the relationship is between the president and the Republican congressional leaders, that literally anything is possible. And what's added to that is the fact, of course, that the president seems to be desperate for some sort of legislative victory, and his vetoing a continuing resolution and shutting down the government may be what he needs to provide red meat for his base. So it's not about governing. It's about politics and image for the president.
Of course, the president knows nothing about the budget, very close to nothing. But what about the people at Treasury and OMB? Is there a staff there that actually knows the mechanics of how the budget works?
There's a staff at OMB and the Treasury that understands how these things work, but it's not clear how much impact they have or how much influence they have. Let's keep in mind that Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin is relatively new in his job, has never really been in government before. And while he keeps insisting that he wants a clean debt ceiling, it's not clear the president is going to go along with that if he has a choice. In addition, remember that OMB Director, Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, is actually not in favor of a clean debt ceiling. He, as a Freedom Caucus member before he was in the House, before he was in the administration, he pushed very hard for the debt ceiling to be used to as a vehicle for other things like big spending cuts or tax cuts. And although supposedly Mnuchin is in charge, Mulvaney is clearly talking behind the scenes. So I think they know what they, you know, there are some people who know what they do, what the administration, what the budget does and what the debt ceiling will do. There are even some probably advising the president on what will happen with the government shutdown or not passing the debt ceiling in time. I'm not sure that matters to the White House. Image is more important to them, and being a tough guy, showing his base that he can control Congress, treating Congress like a wholly owned subsidiary as opposed to an equal partner that's provided in the Constitution. That's what this president is all about, and that's why everybody I talk to is kind of saying, we don't know what's going to happen. It's just too unpredictable.
Now, I thought that a lot of the lunatics have been escorted out, and you know the grown-ups are now supposedly in charge. This has had no effect on the fiscal politics at 1600?
No, not at 1600. First of all, I'm not sure how many of the grown-ups are there. Second, I'm not sure how much influence they have. But some of the grown-ups are not as grown-up as you think. I mean, let's remember Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, was a bomb thrower when he was in Congress and seems intent on doing that now. Mnuchin is not a big political player. Steve Cohen is on the outs. The head of the National Economic Council is on the outs with the president at the moment, and it seems to be begging to be fired. The president has criticized Paul Ryan. He's criticized Mitch McConnell. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have criticized him back. So this is very much everybody retreating to his or her own corner and basically saying, you can't make me. And you know what, Doug? They actually can't make them. I mean, this is the kind of thing where there should be an easy resolution to this problem. They should just pass a simple extension of the continuing resolution to give themselves more time. They should pass a simple extension of the debt ceiling or a suspension of the debt ceiling to give themselves more time, and they should pass a temporary short-term aid bill providing aid for the hurricane-affected areas so that Congress has got between October and December 31st to do some work and get an agreement. It may not come to that. There may be a shutdown on October 1st just because the president wants to show everybody he can make it happen.
What is Congress thinking about the wall? Do they want to go along with him? Is there any base for that?
There are some, obviously, particularly in the Republican Party. Democrats seem to be adamantly against it, so adamantly against it that I think they would withhold their votes for a continuing resolution, that is a bill to keep the government open, if it included money for the wall. In fact, I'm pretty sure they would. Interestingly enough, you've got a lot of Republicans from Texas and some of the border states that don't want the wall and think it's a waste of money. Or will defend their Hispanic, Latino, voters. So, there is a big enough group in favor of the wall and in favor of doing Trump's bidding that, they could literally stop everything cold if they insisted that the wall be funded. They literally have enough votes to stop the Republicans from having a majority. But just to give you an idea of how crazy this is, earlier today, Representative Steve King, who's a far-right, uber-conservative Freedom Caucus member, said that money should be taken out of Planned Parenthood and food stamps to pay for the wall. Now, that's not a popular view, but the fact that with three or four weeks to go before the end of the fiscal year and these decisions having been made, someone could make that kind of wild statement shows you that things have not settled down and that we're still in the hyperventilation stage.
Now, whatever happened to food stamps? It used to have a pretty strong base of support from fairly conservative people in agricultural states who like expanding the market for food. Has that all disappeared?
No, no, it's still there. Look, this is just the rantings of a single member of Congress who was just trying to get on television or get quoted in the newspapers. But I don't think anyone thinks there's a real chance of it happening. But food stamps is actually very, very, as you suggest, is really as much an agricultural program as it is an urban welfare program, and it's got a lot of support across the country in both urban and rural districts, farming districts. I don't expect anything to happen from that. I think there'll be people who will bitch about it, but I suspect that whatever spending is needed will be provided.
And now, Chris, we're in the midst of one of the greatest disasters in American history. How well funded is FEMA at this point?
FEMA's got a little bit of money through the end of the year, but certainly not enough to deal with a flood of, I'm going to use biblical proportions here. And something that, as we're speaking now, is expected to get worse, not better. So FEMA is going to, and then FEMA is now talking about having to be in the Houston area in Texas for years, not months in recovery, but for years. So we're probably talking about, and I'm guessing, $30 to $50 billion, $30 to $50 billion with a B, more than FEMA was already going to get, and that assumes there won't be any other major natural disaster in the meantime. FEMA is not that well funded to handle that, and we'll need these emergency appropriations, which means the deficit's going to be higher, government borrowing is going to be higher, and interestingly enough, how this all comes together in September, if FEMA has to spend more than was expected in September because of the floods, which it certainly will, it will exacerbate the government's debt ceiling problem. The government's likely to run out of cash earlier, and the debt ceiling will be needed sooner rather than later than we had anticipated.
And FEMA, the FEMA budget includes the flood insurance program?
No, that's I'm not sure whether it's managed by FEMA, but it's that's a separate program, and that's an interesting situation because the flood insurance program, which is already under attack from some conservatives in Congress that want to raise the premiums that people pay, already is in debt because of Katrina and doesn't have enough money even close to dealing with what's going on now and to pay off the claims that are likely to be made from it. We're talking again $20-30 billion in arrears. So there'll probably be a temporary extension of the flood insurance program, national flood insurance program, which expires at the end of September 30th as well. So a whole nother thing that has to get done by October 1st. Let me repeat something I said earlier. If this was 20 years ago, if the House, Senate, and White House had supermajorities, House and Senate had supermajorities, and weren't worried about filibusters, even then this would be difficult to get done in the short time that Congress will be in session in September. So given the craziness going on now with hyper-partisanship and with compromise being considered the equivalent of collaborating with the enemy, this just isn't going to happen quickly. And there's all kinds of opportunities for games. So I suspect that you and I will be talking about this through the end of the year, and that probably this will come down to another series of votes around December 31st.
I'm speaking with the veteran federal budget expert, Stan Collender. And what are the risks of a Treasury bond default?
First of all, it's never happened, and I suspect it won't happen. But it's almost certainly going to raise the cost of borrowing going forward for taxpayers. That is, interest rates will be higher simply because there'll be a risk premium that no one thought they needed to charge before. There's that. There's a possibility that foreign capital is going to fly and go somewhere else to look for a safe haven rather than U.S. bonds. Simply because people can't be as assured with this political situation they're going to get paid back at the right time. I mean, if there's one default, the first one in American history, what's to say there won't be another one a year later? That's what the concern will be. Now, let me give you a positive note here. It's not inconceivable to me that Congress and the President decide not to raise the debt ceiling, but to suspend it, and to suspend it for 3 years. That would be good news for the market because it would mean there'd be no more debt ceiling crises in the meantime. But it's a little bit of a long shot. It's possible, but it's a little bit of a long shot, but certainly an option that's being at least talked about behind closed doors.
What kind of people are talking about that? Because I thought the debt ceiling was very valuable to a lot of people politically.
Well, yeah, but that's a small minority. That's mostly the Freedom Caucus people, which is, I'm going to say, 40 people in the House. But if Republican leaders don't like dealing with it, I mean, look, it almost got, they basically did force John Boehner out of the speakership. The White House doesn't want to have to keep dealing with it. Republicans don't like voting for debt ceiling increases, neither do Democrats for that matter. So there is some very high level behind the scenes discussions at the leadership level about whether or not a suspension is more valuable and more doable than having to vote for one or more increases between now and the 2020 election.
And does anyone think that Trump would go along with that?
You said it earlier. It's not clear that he would instinctively know what this would do for him, and he might decide maybe with advice from John Kelly, his chief of staff, from Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin. Trump might very well decide to go along with it so he doesn't have to deal with the debt ceiling issue before the next presidential election also. I'm sure it hasn't risen to the White House level yet because it's just being discussed behind closed doors on Capitol Hill.
It's stunning to me that a substantial number of Republicans would be so casual about bringing default risk to U.S. Treasury bonds. You know, the gold standard of financial paper in the world, and to bring that under a cloud seems like such a betrayal of everything they're supposed to stand for. Do you understand how they could be so indifferent to the repercussions of it?
Yeah, look, Doug, the problem you're having is you're thinking rationally about this. Think politically, and you get people like, again, Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, and his Freedom Caucus former colleagues, are saying, you know what, this must-pass legislation is something that the Democrats will take very seriously. If they want this, if they want to avoid a default, then they're going to have to give us something. That is, this previously considered absolutely must-pass, must-sign legislation is something we can use as a legislative vehicle for things we wouldn't otherwise get and Democrats wouldn't otherwise vote for. It's an enormous game of chicken. For some Freedom Caucus members, they don't think a default is either possible or likely to happen. They also think that there's a way for the Treasury or the Federal Reserve to pay bondholders first and everyone else second so that the repercussions for the U.S. economy would be much less. The Fed and the Treasury say that's impossible. And the truth is nobody really knows because we've never done this before. It's the height of irresponsibility. But let's remember, for many Freedom Caucus members' constituents, for the Donald Trump base, not voting for the debt ceiling is a badge of honor. It's a campaign event. Going home to your constituents and being able to say, I voted against raising federal debt and any more borrowing. I want to save the future for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It may be totally untrue economically and financially, but it plays well politically. So that's what you've got to think about. Stop thinking rationally about this. Stop thinking like an economist or a financial guy and start thinking like someone running for re-election from an area in, let's say, Mississippi.
Well, yeah, I can understand how the more downscale constituents of the Republican Party really wouldn't care so much about Treasury bonds. But the more upscale ones, and there are plenty of them, have a fairly healthy portfolio, as I'm guessing. And a default would really hit them personally. Did they not put two and two together?
Some do, and obviously it was pressure from business and Wall Street last time that got Congress to ultimately raise the debt ceiling or deal with it with a suspension. But it's not clear whether they want to get involved. It's not clear how much they understand. It's not clear how much they fear the White House. So they may be quietly adjusting their portfolios in the meantime to deal with this additional risk. But again, nobody really knows how bad this is going to be. There are some people who think it's, excuse the expression, fake news to say that disaster will strike if the government doesn't raise the debt ceiling in time and runs out of cash.
Of course, it would be default even if the government chose to pay interest on its bonds and didn't pay other bills. So that would be also default even if not in the bond market.
Yeah, I think the legal term is technical default. That is when you don't pay a contract when it comes due. And in fact, that would get the government to incur additional expenses, not just for the higher interest rates that would occur, but because there are fast payment provisions and penalties that the government would end up paying. That may be the ultimate fiscal irony here. That is, if Republicans or Democrats or anybody in Congress or the White House holds out and shuts down the government, that's going to cost more money, maybe billions upon billions of dollars, depending on how long it goes on. The same is obviously true of the debt ceiling. If they don't raise it in time, it's going to cost billions of dollars in probably legal fees and additional interest payments, the interest charges as rates go up. Even a quarter of a point, given the size of the government debt, would be pretty substantial. And yet, the people who say they want to shut down the government or they're not going to vote for a debt ceiling often do it under the guise of fiscal responsibility. It's actually the height of fiscal irresponsibility.
How in control is the leadership of their constituents or their delegations? Like, do McConnell and Ryan run tight ships, or will the crew mutiny?
The best way to look at this is the best way to answer that question is to talk about what happened with the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace effort. It failed once in the House before they barely snuck one by in several weeks later that no one thought would ever be adopted, but was passable. Only to find that the whole thing collapsed in the Senate. So to say that McConnell has control over his people is giving him too much benefit of the doubt. And we know that Ryan, like Boehner before him, can't control the Freedom Caucus and can't necessarily control the Tuesday group, the moderates. I just wrote a piece about part of this. There's not one Republican Party working together. There are six or seven. You've got the conservatives and the moderates in the House. You've got a different groups of conservatives and the moderates in the Senate. And the four groups don't coordinate with each other. The conservatives in the House don't coordinate with the conservatives in the Senate, et cetera. Ryan and McConnell make up two separate groups because they've got institutional responsibilities as well as political responsibilities that often conflict. And then you've got Donald Trump, who is, for many people, not a Republican to begin with, but not acting like a Republican who wants to work together. I mean, look, if this was a Lyndon Johnson situation, he would have just gotten the Democrats together, maybe the Republicans as well, and said, all right, what do we need to make this work? And they would have worked this out. I mean, there would be no issue in September. We'd be, the obvious answer, the short-term continuing resolution, a short-term extension of the CR, would have already been negotiated. And then they would have voted on it in early September, and there'd be no suspense. Instead, it's like a Perils of Pauline silent movie where someone is being tied to the track at the end of every episode. It's the leadership has no control. The White House has no control over the leadership. And no real political smarts, it appears, when it comes to legislation. So, and the Democrats are just holding back and saying, we're not going to help yourselves if you're not going to do it on your own. So, I mean, this is as crazy a legislative situation as I've ever seen, and I've been in Washington for 40 years.
You mentioned the ACA. Is doing anything about that all done, or will they just chip away at it gradually, but a wholesale overhaul is impossible?
Well, right now, wholesale overhaul is impossible. I mean, technically, procedurally, there is still a way for Congress to bring it up in the Senate under the reconciliation rules, which would prevent a filibuster. So it's not dead. It's not dead and buried. But unless some member of Congress, some Republican, retires or dies, please forgive me, I'm not wishing that on anybody, but that often happens. Until the next election, there's nothing going to happen on ACA because they just don't have the votes to get anything done. Now, it's not clear, even if there's a one or two vote change, that they still will be able to agree on anything. I mean, I think that in spite of what the White House wants, Senate's moving on. They'd like to do tax reform. That's probably not going to happen, but they want to stop talking about ACA because that was one of their biggest failures of decades.
What about tax reform? I mean, there are all these grand promises coming out of Cohn, but can they do anything?
No. I mean, I suspect you don't get answers like that too often from your guests, but tax reform was always going to be more difficult than health care, and health care was virtually impossible. Even at this point, if they wanted to not do, quote, reform, but actually just tax cuts, the increase in the deficit would be anathema to many members of Congress, particularly Republicans. I suspect, given the additional spending they're going to have to do on Hurricane Harvey, with the additional stuff that they want for additional money they want for defense, this would be a bridge too far for a lot of members. We're talking about raising the annual deficit to well over $1 trillion every year through the next decade under those circumstances. That's just not going to happen.
So from a distance, it looks like the whole scene is one of insanity and disaster, and it looks the same from up close.
Oh yeah. In fact, I mean, as an analyst, as someone who's watched Washington for a long time, you watch it for two reasons. One is to try to figure out what's going on, but two, for the simple, it's the political equivalent of watching a car wreck or a train wreck, or you know, it's the voyeuristic attitude, application of all of this. You just sit there with your jaw hanging out, hanging down every day, saying what else is going to happen that's going to make this crazier. And what's the best way I can put this to you is what used to be the unthinkable has now become the merely implausible, but not the impossible in Washington. So whatever bad ideas, whatever bad dreams you might be having about Washington, double them, and you probably get a sense of how bad it really is.
That was Stan Cullender, who's been immersed in federal budget issues for several decades, now from the vantage point of the MSL Group. You can find him on Twitter as The Budget Guy. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the second movement of Brahms' Quintet for Strings and Piano, performed by the Amadeus Quartet with Christoph Eschenbach on the piano. Next, North Korea. The standard posture towards that country by our political and pundit classes is one of mockery. The leadership is hilarious and irrational, with a taste for funny hairstyles. Reality is more complex. One thing that gets forgotten in U.S. coverage of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, is that the U.S. completely destroyed it during the Korean War. Though that was more than 60 years ago, North Koreans remember this well. And when Trump makes noises about fire and fury, they understandably get nervous. Here to make sense of the superficially senseless is Tim Shorrock. Tim grew up in South Korea and Japan and has been writing about the region for a long time. You can find his work on both Koreas on the nation's website. Tim Shorrock. So first of all, what do you make of that shark into the darkness over Japan the other day? What was North Korea up to? Does anyone know? Can you figure it out?
First of all, I agree that it's pretty provocative, but I also think that the last few tests they've done, the last few shots of missiles they've done, have been kind of proportional to what the U.S. is doing, the U.S. and South Korea are doing. So there's this kind of dance going on between the two sides that I see in preparation for actually negotiations happening. Let me just explain that a little bit, okay?
Okay, I was going to ask you, we don't get the coverage so much of what the U.S. and South Korea are doing, so what...
That's the problem here, is that, you know, they just say exercises, but they don't, you know, say, like, you know, what kind of exercises these are, military exercises. So, like, let me just start, like, when it got really heated up, I mean, after Trump said, you know, fire and brimstone, et cetera, and basically threatened to nuke all of North Korea, unless they, you know, behaved, you know, that set off this kind of war of words and also war of exercises, I would say, where, you know, the U.S. had plans for what they called, you know, preventive war. McMaster was talking about this quite openly. And, you know, there was a report, quite a stunning report, actually, in NBC News about 2 weeks ago, sort of at the height of this, where they said the Pentagon had plans to do preemptive attacks on like more than two dozen missile sites throughout North Korea. And that they were going to be carried out by, you know, B-1B bombers based in Guam. And, this was, you know, clearly the plan that had been decided on in terms of that they wanted to do a preemptive strike. And so it was after that, DPRK and Kim Jong-un said, okay, we have a plan to fire some missiles toward Guam. And why Guam? Well, because that's where these bombers are based.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that was barely mentioned, if at all, in the U.S. press reports on this.
I know. It wasn't mentioned at all. I mean, NBC did its report, and that was it, right? But, I mean, you know, on top of that, you know, that report came on top of all these public statements by McMaster and others. So then, you know, the North said, okay, we're going to do this, you know, send these missiles and they'll put Guam in an enveloping fire. That was their words. And then, you know, the U.S., of course, you know, Trump reacted and you know, Mattis, Secretary of Defense, said if they shoot those missiles, we'll shoot them down and so on. And then, you know, a day after, so after that, Kim Jong-un visited his missile command and said, you know, basically, okay, we're going to wait and see what the Yankees do is the way he put it. And he basically called that off, called that Guam strike off, you know, or the Guam test, whatever it was going to be, called that off. He backed down. And the first paper to pick that up, really, and go with it was the Wall Street Journal. And they pretty much, you know, nailed it. And then after you notice after that, Trump and Tillerson, Trump said, you know, actually complimented Kim Jong-un by name, right, saying, oh, he's finally getting the message. And Tillerson said, you know, they also mentioned around that time that there had been, they had not tested a missile for about 2 weeks, and that was sort of meeting the coming close to meeting the standards he and Mattis had set for negotiations, you know, which were like that they stopped these missile tests and nuclear tests. So in other words, you know, North Korea's response was sort of proportional. Okay, you're going to bomb us from Guam. Okay, we're going to shoot missiles at. We can shoot missiles at Guam. It's basically telling the U.S. they have the capability to do that. And so then, you know, meanwhile, you know, there's been discussions, you know, leading up to these negotiations. I think there's going to be negotiations, but there's been a group called it's a sort of track two team of former U.S. officials, former U.S. State Department people, people like Joel Witt, who was a State Department guy who helped negotiate the 1994 framework. He and other people from various institutions have been meeting with North Korean diplomats and the senior levels of North Korean government in Pyongyang, in Oslo, and other places. And they just have these sort of open discussions and sort of what are your concerns, here's our concerns kind of thing. And they're sort of unofficial talks, but nevertheless, these Americans go back and, you know, brief the Trump administration, brief the U.S. government. And these have been going on, and actually, you know, earlier, beginning of the term of Trump, the U.S. delegate to the North Korean talks was actually his congressionally designated position of he's an ambassador on human rights in North Korea. Yoon, he actually met with North Korean foreign ministry people at the side of one of these meetings, and they continued these meetings, officials. So Trump actually was talking directly to North Korean government at the beginning of the, you know, in the spring. And out of those discussions came the release of this one young Virginia student who was held in the DPRK, who was in a coma and who died soon after coming back. But that was part of the diplomatic exchanges that were going on. So, you know, and then meanwhile, Tillerson and Mattis have been saying over and over again very emphatically that there's going to be a diplomatic solution, not a war solution. You know, so there's a sort of, you know, diplomatic dance going on. And so when the U.S. makes threats, the U.S. threats are basically, we're going to destroy your nation. We're going to wipe out your whole people. You're going to wipe out the country. Whereas they make their threats and they shoot their missiles like they did yesterday, terrifying a lot of people in Japan. They shot them over Japan, but they're short-range intermediate missiles. And that's clearly to say, you know, there's a war and you're having these big exercises now. We can certainly hit your bases in Japan or Guam. That rocket flew almost as far as Guam, but it went north instead of south toward Guam. And so they're messaging, you know, we can do this, and the U.S. is saying we can do this, and they're sort of squaring off. And so the U.S. calls it, this is an outrage, and the U.N. meets and so on, because it does violate U.N. sanctions and U.N. Statements over the years. But they consider it their right to, you know, build their own defense capability. I think there's going to be negotiations.
You pointed out when we were here a couple of months ago, the North Koreans have very still vivid memories of what the United States did to their country during the Korean War. It may have been 65 years ago, but yeah, just remind us what the scale of the devastation was.
It was total devastation. I mean, you know, the U.S. After North Korean forces, you know, crossed the border and went into South Korea, took almost the whole peninsula. The U.S. invaded with MacArthur at the head, of course, you know, toward the north at Incheon, and then they drove the North Korean forces north across the border, and then Truman made this decision to actually invade North Korea, and they went into North Korea at full force and went all the way up almost to the Yellow River with China, which is when Mao Zedong had his, you know, army go in and drive the U.S. out. And when they, once they drove, the Chinese drove the U.S. military back across the 38th parallel, the U.S. commenced this bombing campaign in the north that basically destroyed everything that was possible to bomb. There was no targets left. They actually, you know, the Air Force stopped bombing. And this was led, of course, by the same people that masterminded the firebombing of Japan, which was terrible enough at the end of World War II, General Curtis LeMay and Robert McNamara. And they did the same in North Korea. And there's, you know, carpet bombing, napalm, killed millions of people in North Korea. And, you know, they flew empty, you know, they flew B-17s that had flown over Hiroshima and Nagasaki and dropped bombs there. They flew B-17s over North Korea, not carrying bombs, but North Koreans didn't do that. And didn't know that until the planes flew out. So it was, you know, it was a horrible, terrible bombing that just destroyed the whole country. So they don't forget that.
What did you make of what we might think of as Bannon's exit interview with the American Prospect, where he said there's no military solution possible? You know, you can't tell me how we can do anything, how we can avoid killing 10 million people in South Korea with, you know, in a short period of time. He made an awful lot of sense.
Yes. He did.
Do you think he's influential within the administration? Was he speaking for anybody there, or are they less rational than he is?
He's definitely not speaking for very many people within the administration. However, that's the way most people in the military think. I mean, you could probably hear the same kind of words out of the Secretary of Defense Mattis's mouth, too. I mean, he said almost as much. You know, this war would be a complete catastrophe. There is no real military solution. I mean, that's the way Bannon put it. But, you know, the U.S. doesn't, that's not the right message to send. The U.S. wants the North Koreans to think anyway that, and of course it does, you know, have the capability to completely destroy them again.
Well, what is McMaster talking about with preventive war then?
He's talking about a war that he thinks they could, like, you know, wipe out the missile launchers or wipe out its nuclear program or something without causing, you know, and then stopping there without sort of, you know, causing a major conflagration throughout the region. The missile that North Korea shot yesterday over Japan was fired from the airport in Pyongyang, where foreigners, including Americans recently, you know, land and leave, you know, come in and come out, you know, so it's like they fired it from the middle of their city. And the fact that they have, you know, rockets that are in their city, so this was said by a couple of analysts today, showing the U.S. that, you know, you try to take out our sites, you're going to be bombing our whole city, you know. So that's the risk you're going to take. They believe that the U.S. still has a hostile intent and could destroy them, and they think, you know, having a, you know, nuclear capability is really their only protection against, you know, regime change, you know, wiping out their regime. So that's the way they see it. Getting back to Bannon, though, it was amazing that when he left, you know, that's what, like, all these sort of people that are supporting a tough policy, they pounce on that. You know, how could he dare say, you know, there's no military solution? And he was reprimanded for that by both Mattis and Tillerson, you know, the next day. You know, you're not supposed to say that. Right. And he also, but he also said somebody there would be willing to, if the North Koreans agree, if the Chinese could pressure the North Koreans into agreeing to some kind of freeze, halt their weapons program, that the U.S. would actually pull U.S. forces out of South Korea. And that would be, that's like unheard of to hear even in the Pentagon. So, that was an opinion probably just held by him inside the White House and even inside the Pentagon.
I'm speaking with the journalist Tim Shorrock, who writes about the Koreas for The Nation, among other places. Okay, so every time you talk about negotiating with North Koreans, the inevitable American reaction, you know, out of the government, out of the pundits, is they're crazy, they're not rational, they're liars, you can't trust them, they break agreements. That's really not the historical record, though, correct?
Not at all. And you know, the idea that they're crazy and irrational is crazy and irrational. You know, I mean, they're not. They have a logic to what they're doing. I mean, it's not crazy to defend yourself with nuclear weapons and their Pyongyang policy, which is, you know, nuclear and military development go together with economic development. That's been, you know, Kim Jong-un's policy. That was his father's policy for a while. I mean, that's been their policy. Like, you know, these things come together. They're part one of the same. Our economy grows as our military grows. It's kind of like, you know, what the U.S. philosophy was during the formation of the national security state in the early 50s. You know, we build a huge military and that's going to pull the economy forward. And in fact, that was the engine of the U.S. economic growth for years in the post-World War II years after what was triggered by the Korean War and that massive spending that took place. So that's their stand. That's very rational. It's nothing irrational about that. Their rocket launches are definitely thought through. There's a deep thinking of strategy behind each shot that they do and how they respond to what the U.S. says. So there's nothing irrational there. And as far as the agreements go, you know, they have made agreements with the United States and other countries and held them. There's been, as I have an article coming out in the next few days that I've been working on for a few weeks for The Nation about the history of the negotiations that took place during the Clinton years in 1994, which is when they froze their nuclear program. And this was, mind you, before they had nuclear weapons. They had, you know, a nuclear power reactor that could, and they were making plutonium out of it. They stopped their nuclear development program for 12 years. No fissionable materials they produced for 12 years. And, you know, in return, the U.S. supplied heavy fuel oil and also there was a plan, and it was actually underway for quite some time, to build two light water reactors that are considered less easy to build nuclear weapons from, that were going to be built by an international consortium. But the biggest part of that agreement was the most important part for the North Koreans was that both sides agreed to give up their, you know, hostile intent toward each other, and they agreed to move forward as expeditiously as possible to full economic and political normalization. And those steps were underway. You know, as I write in this article, The Nation, like, you know, 1994, 1995, 1996, after the agreement was signed, you know, they're scouting each other's capitals for embassies. You know, the U.S. was in Pyongyang, was looking at the East, you know, the former East German embassy is where they would be located. And these oil shipments went through, even though, you know, the Republican Congress tried to cut funds for it. The shipments went through. That agreement held, and then it was actually the basis of a long-term negotiation in the, you know, two- or three-year negotiation in the late 90s, led by, it was President Clinton's Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry. They negotiated, came very close to finalizing an agreement on missiles, in which North Korea would have frozen all its missiles and would have closed down its missile production. And that agreement was still pending when Bush came to office. And Bush came to office with the intent of, like, you know, John Bolton, people like that on his staff, Donald Rumsfeld, with the intent of basically doing away with that agreement, because they still saw North Korea as a mortal enemy. And so that the agreement came apart in the end of 2002 and the beginning of 2003, when Bush accused them of having a uranium-based program to get nukes, which they only had bought. By that time, they had bought some machines, but they didn't have a program that was producing any weapon-grade uranium. And using that as an excuse, Bush threw out the agreement and canceled. And, you know, within months, they started up their nuclear program again. And in 2006, they exploded their first bomb. So, when you remember, he put North Korea on the Axis of Evil list as well, you know. So, showed North Korea that, the U.S. has no intention of, you know, agreeing to dropping its hostile policy. And today, when you see North Korean statements, when you read them, they'll say, the U.S. media and the government only quotes the top part of it. They say, we will not negotiate our away our nuclear weapons or our missiles. They always add, unless the United States drops its hostile policy. The media never tells you the second part of it. So they just say, North Korea refuses to negotiate its nuclear weapons. And the other side of it is if we drop our hostile policy. And so, you know, the question is, you know, can that be done? Will the United States drop its hostile policy? And if so, how? So that's a question for the North Koreans. And I think that's the question for the United States and for us citizens to start getting at. You know, how can we drop that hostile policy, and what can change to make them see that there is not a real threat from the United States?
What was the policy during the Obama years?
It was worse than Bush. Obama basically came to office, and this had, you know, whatever the U.S. does in North Korea, with North Korea, has a lot to do with who's in power in South Korea. Like, you know, when Bush was in power, and of course, you know, Bush threw out the agreement, but then after that, he did negotiate after they set off their bomb. You know, that you remember the six-party talks that began in 2005 and lasted till 2008. So Bush did negotiate with them. But at the time, there was a progressive government in South Korea. At that time, under Bush, No Mu-hyun, first Kim Dae-jung and then No Mu-hyun. And they both carried out what they, you know, the sunshine policy of, you know, exchanges with North Korea and reducing tension through economic development and, you know, cultural exchange, sports exchange, and so on. And those, during those years, many South Koreans visited the North and vice versa. There was a lot of people interchange between North and South at that time, and kind of reduced, you know, North Korea's image in the South as an enemy state, you know, because of that period of time. In 2008, this real right-wing guy was elected in South Korea, Lee Myung-bak, who was completely against engagement with North Korea. And when he came to office, like, he didn't like the agreement, the agreed framework either. And he started putting economic conditions on the agreement that Bush and the six-party talks had negotiated, under which North Korea would give up its weapons. And he wanted, like, stronger written assurances of inspections and this kind of thing. And then North Korean said no. And because it had not been in the original agreement, and Obama came in and said, okay, we're going to basically side with a South Korean leader who he became best friends with. He said, he's my best friend in Asia and all this. And they had a lot of articles written about their friendship. Anyway, he went along with that. And from the beginning, his people, you know, said, you know, talking to North Korea is useless because they're going to collapse. The idea was, you know, they're going to go away, and, you know, we don't really have to take this seriously. And when there was tensions, I've just been writing about this. People may remember the movie that was made about Kim Jong-un by Sony Studios, in which he was assassinated and his head blown up in the screen. And they, supposedly North Korea hacked Sony after that. And then the U.S. imposed very strict additional sanctions on North Korea for that. Basically declared economic war on them. But at the same time, Obama had started this cyber war, so thinking he could bring down their missile program by, you know, getting into their computers and into the rockets of computers and screwing up launches and this kind of thing. And they basically launched, you know, an offensive cyber war against North Korea in the last few years of his administration. And there was tension between the South Korean right-wing government and the North Koreans at that time, had almost led to some border, you know, clashes and another, you know, big crisis. And Obama, under his term, vastly increased the military exercises. You know, we remember the shift, the pivot to Asia. You know, that was part of this whole, you know, shift in military to U.S. military, you know, towards Asia, units into Asia. And, you know, this reflected in South Korea. And as tensions increased with North Korea, he expanded these exercises, and they began to include things like practicing regime change operations. So they'd come out and, you know, they'd call it decapitation exercises, where they destroy the North Korean leadership. practicing as part of these military exercises. And so, you know, actually Obama policy really worsened the situation. Much worse, got much worse than even under Bush.
All right, we're just about out of time. So do you think will there be negotiation and cool heads will prevail, or are we headed towards a hot war in the Korean Peninsula?
We're not headed toward a hot war. There's going to be this kind of war on words and, you know, signaling by, you know, stepping up. Maybe the U.S. is going to send bombers toward Korean skies soon as a message again. But I think they're moving slowly, ever so slowly, into a negotiation. And how that unfolds, who knows? But I think that's where we're headed.
That was the journalist Tim Schrock. You can find a lot of his work on the Nation's website, including the article on North Korea he mentioned in the interview. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. More Brahms chamber music performed by the Amadeus Quartet. This is from the first movement of the Quintet for Strings. No piano this time. Till next week. Bye.